Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hello, this is Shayla Kulkarni from Annapolis, Maryland, and you're listening to the Absolutely Fabulous Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, folks, and thank you to Shayla. Who you heard in our intro there, Shayla from Annapolis, Maryland, home of the United States Navy. Fun fact for you about Annapolis, Maryland. So thank you to Shayla. David's here. Hello, David.
Hello. How are we doing today?
We're doing good. Matt's here. How are you doing, Matt?
Very well, thank you. Very well.
Everyone is present and correct to talk about the fact that Carlos Alcaraz and Iga Świątek are the champions. And I thought if I keep that nice and generic, we can reuse it for the next decade and more.
Yeah.
Because I think that'll be a very useful time saver.
Yeah, we think back to Thursday's show, and I think I left it in Matt's hands to do the title, and he came up with who can stop Iga Świątek and Carlos Alcaraz. And honestly, it seemed like the most inevitable conclusion to this tournament that I can remember in a heck of a long time. And that's even with some really strong opposition. But that's how much better than the rest of the field they felt. Now, I know I'm not going to start saying that this means that that will necessarily be the case all year and all the rest of it. But just at the moment, they are so far ahead of what else was.
I mean, you've literally predicted him to win the next Grand Slam. But,
well,
but yes.
That's true. Feeling quite good about that at the moment.
It's true though, Matt, isn't it? I mean, two very different scenarios. You know, Iga Świątek becoming the first woman ever to win the first three 1,000 level events of the season. People have won three in a row before, but never the first three of the season. I guess on paper, we might look back at that and go, oh, it seemed vaguely inevitable. And Carlos Alcaraz somehow seemed inevitable, despite the fact that, you know, he's not even ranked inside the world's top 10. He'd never been to a final of 1,000 before. He's 18 years old. Nobody that young had, no male player that young had ever won Miami before. And yet that seemed inevitable too. Like, of course they won those titles.
Yeah, it's nice when something ages well. And Thursday's pod title did, which is good. And yeah, it did feel like there was a connection between what they were doing. You know, I wasn't trying to compare Alcaraz's career to Świątek so far, or, as David said, say that they're going to win everything going forward. I think they're going to win a lot going forward. But just this tournament, it had, by Thursday, it had the feel to it that Alcaraz and Świątek were the players to beat. And Alcaraz came close to losing. I'm sure we'll talk about his match against Kecmanovic, but otherwise they were head and shoulders above everyone else, really.
And that is despite the fact that Iga Świątek played full-time Grand Slam champion Naomi Osaka in her final. I'm a bit torn about how to deal with this match, because in some ways it was a desperate disappointment. I was so pumped for it, folks. It was too much, I would say. I worry that I jinxed it a little bit, and I felt so good about how pumped I was, sort of at about I mean, the first game was an epic, wasn't it? And I thought, yep, great. I felt so comfortable in the fact that it was going to be a great match. And I think up until about 3-3, that continued to be the case. It was really nip and tuck. And then it just felt like everything changed. Iga Świątek got a break, and that was kind of it. I mean, yeah, the first set felt competitive-ish for the remainder, but the second set didn't feel competitive at all. I mean, wasn't competitive at all. I do wonder if there was some sort of injury or niggle at play for Osaka, because she really almost looked like she gave up in the latter stages of that second set. Now, it might just be because she had no answers. Frankly, Świątek made her look one-dimensional, because she was just trying to hit through her Osaka, and it was so clear that wasn't going to work. And it was kind of like a shrug, well, I don't know what else I can do. And frankly, the answer is probably there was nothing else you could have done with Świątek in that kind of form. But yeah, it wasn't the duel that I wanted it to be. There were many aspects of the match that I enjoy. Świątek is just, she makes you smile, doesn't she? She's good news. There were lots of aspects that I enjoyed, but what I wanted was a fight to the death, David. didn't get it.
I shared the feeling of jinxing it, because after three games, I wanted to tell everybody about what I was witnessing, as though it was only me who was watching it. I was shouting up the stairs to the kids, you've got to see this. I was messaging you, I was tweeting about these three games that I just witnessed that had taken 20-odd minutes, and these two greats of the game in terms of talent, really supernatural talents, just going locking horns and going toe-to-toe. And there was a rally, I think, that was finished with an Osaka backhand down the line, having been under the gun from an onslaught of ground strokes from Świątek, that just, I jumped out of my seat at it, because that was the moment. But that was as good as it got as a contest. Mm. And I felt we then saw the difference in match toughness between the two players. You called it in our conversation baked in confidence that Świątek has got now. And that sums it up, I think. It was pretty flimsy, really, the confidence of Osaka. It was built on a week's worth of good wins over people she's just better than. And then when she came up against somebody that's of a similar sort of skill set and standard, who was just way more confident and way more self-assured, and all the boxes were ticked in her game at the moment, it was just one-sided. And also, you saw that ambition again from Świątek. She's kind of a killer on the court. She just wants to win so badly that she doesn't let you off for a second. As nice as she is, and they have a really nice rapport, these two, and you could see it afterwards, but during the match, it was absolutely ruthless.
Yeah, Matt, confidence is such a buzzword in all sport, isn't it? That you almost, I mean, I almost find myself sort of glaze over when ex-pros talk about confidence, because, you know, it's just so commonplace, and it's rarely sort of explained what it really means and what it really feels like. And I felt like we watched a demonstration of what sporting confidence really, truly is in that final, because it seemed on the surface of it that Osaka has it. She's the one with four Grand Slam titles under her belt, former world number one. You know, it's her home tournament in Miami, or she thinks of it as one of her home tournaments. She had been sweeping all before her. She had overturned one-sided head-to-heads against her. You know, she was beating players that she used to not beat, even when she was in her pomp. It all looked, to all intents and purposes, like she should have bags of confidence, but it was all surface level. Once Iga Świątek drilled down into it, it shook and it crumbled away, which is entirely understandable. I don't think she'd played a top 10 player for 2 years before playing Iga Świątek. And you look at a stat like that and you think, well, of course. But by contrast, Świątek's confidence is just I mean, pretty much at an absolute peak of where sporting confidence can be, I think.
Yeah, it was pretty much a perfect example of that Andy Roddick, I don't know whether you would call it a maxim or something, where he says he would take confidence over experience any day. And I think, you know, Osaka is the one, you know, compared to Świątek, with even more big match experience. She's won four times the number of majors. She's won more big titles. But in terms of confidence at the moment, and yeah, that expression you use, baked in confidence, Świątek has that. And not only does she have that in just this winning streak she's on, 17 matches now, she's also got it in these recent big matches. And in fact, all the big matches she's ever played, she has turned up and played extremely well. I think the second set of every 1,000 level event or Grand Slam final she's played has been 6-1 or 6-love. You know, she's such a good front runner. Once she gets ahead in a match, and we saw it was the perfect example against Osaka. Once she gets ahead, there doesn't seem to be any stopping her. She figures out what she needs to do in a match and she just keeps doing it. And I thought the way she turned Osaka's pace back on her, whipped it back, the way she slides into the ball to defend Osaka's pace, it was just a masterclass. And yes, it was disappointing that it didn't end up being that sort of three-set epic I think we all felt it could be, but still I think it was a great occasion. You know, I don't think you were alone with your excitement. That was as much sort of big match buzz as I can remember going into a match. And you know, in terms of the way you judge that, just in the stadium, it felt like there was a buzz. People following it online, it felt like there was a lot of conversation and everyone was watching it. And okay, the match didn't turn out to be what it could have been, but it was still great to see those two players go against each other. And you felt like whatever the scoreline would be, there would be an interesting storyline from it. And the one we've got is Iga Świątek just proving that she's the best player in the world right now, repeatedly. And that's pretty exciting.
I don't want to end the discussion of this final and this extraordinary run that Świątek's on a bum note, but did the result make you yearn for Ash Barty? Because yes, it did me. Because if Ash Barty hadn't announced her retirement then, you know, if she weren't retiring, or if we didn't know that she were retiring, we would be talking right now about whether Świątek is in fact the best player in the world, and we would be desperately yearning for the matchup between them to decide in our minds and in reality which of them is the best player in the world. And there's a strong case to be made, having seen the tennis that we just have from Świątek, that regardless of Ash Barty, she's the best player in the world right now, but we'll never see it. And that's really sad. Sorry, but it's sad, isn't it?
I still could see a year in the future when Ash Barty decides she wants to find out. Actually, her curiosity comes out and she ends up making a comeback to see for herself. I think she's young enough to do that in 4 years if she wants to do. But I didn't think that immediately, because I still feel like if this is work in progress from Osaka, I was more disappointed that Osaka couldn't get her best out, because I think her best absolutely is a match for those two. And I would love to... That's the rivalry I'm now looking forward to. But when you mentioned it, yeah, my mind did slip towards that. And there are, and also to Andreescu, you know, because I think we may have seen the best of her. And that would be a
God,
shame.
Oh, God, David.
Yeah, it's a terrible thing to think, isn't it?
Hang on, she's been tweeting hopeful things.
Mm.
She's been making me feel hopeful. She Good. Tweeted praying hands emoji and soon.
Yep, I really hope that her best is yet to come.
But you don't think it is?
Well, I don't know. I don't feel confident. I think that we've seen, what is it? Is it we're 2.5 years now since she won
that
title?
But she's done an Eat, Pray, Love, David. She's rejuvenated.
I really hope so, because I think
she's been to. Is it Costa Rica? She's been to. think she might have been on a retreat in Costa Rica.
I'm not as on the Insta
and
as you.
Eaten a lot of avocado,
right.
And done some mindfulness, and she's coming back.
Good. I really hope so.
Fueled by avocado and essential oils.
I was really not prepared to, in this podcast, have to envision a world where we've seen the best of Bianca Andreescu already.
No, can you tell how taken aback I am?
You've taken us to a dark place, David.
You know where I'm coming from there, don't you?
Of course it's possible,
yeah,
but I'm not
possible.
Prepared to say it out loud yet.
No, I can't contemplate that. I mean, going back to Barty and Iga Świątek, I mean, I can't get over the fact that just 10 days ago we were talking about Barty retiring, and the way Świątek has just stepped up into that void. I think there could have been any time in the last couple of years where Barty might have retired and we would have seen the number one spot change a lot. It would have really felt like there wasn't a world number one. And okay, Barty has retired, and you know, I do sort of still think of her as kind of the best player in the world. But equally, I think Świątek is filling that void already. And in terms of the rivalry, I think there is potential for an Osaka-Świątek rivalry on a hard court. Like, I think we have seen Osaka play tennis that can be this good at various points in her career, but it has always been either the end of the season around the US Open time or the start of the season around the Australian Open time. What I would have loved about the Barty-Świątek rivalry is that it could have been all year round, because they are all surface players and there was that potential for them to sort of jostle for position and be a dual narrative throughout the season. And I don't think we're going to quite get that with Osaka. Really, really positive quotes from her about how much she's looking forward to embracing clay and grass this season. And I'm here for all of that. But it's a big work in progress for her on those surfaces. And I think some slightly lower expectations might help her this season. But I'm not expecting her to be a sort of real force yet on those surfaces in the way she is on a hard court. And I think we would have got that with Świątek and Barty. So, yeah, I was watching that match a little bit thinking of Barty. And, you know, that's the impact she had on the sport. She was the world number one. She was the best player. Of course, we are going to miss her. But equally, Świątek's doing an incredible job of stepping up.
Mm. She said she's going to start watching videos of Nadal, Osaka, and his movement to try and improve her movement on clay.
Yeah, it's never worked for me. But Osaka's way better.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I've watched quite a lot of Nadal play tennis and it's not gone in by osmosis yet. But
do you think she should be concentrating in a way more on grass and trying to, because it's quite a big ask, isn't it, to try and crack them both? When you're a hard court player.
I get the impression from her quotes that she's really got a thing in her head about grass. I think she feels more uncomfortable on grass than she does on
really?
Clay. I think she.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah,
Why would that be? Do you think?
I think it's the movement. I mean, from the outside, I agree with you. I don't see any reason why she can't figure it out on grass. But you've really got to believe with grass, and I think there's a mental block there in the way there isn't on clay.
I wonder if she's just got to
possibly she should invert that because it, as you say, it was you that said, Matt, you know, expectations wise she's possibly expecting too much of herself on clay. She thinks, oh, I can figure that out, you know, I'll watch a few Nadal videos and I'll figure it out, and sort of on grass she thinks, God, I might never figure that out, and maybe she needs, you know,
watch some Agassi videos.
To balance the two, and you've probably got the right attitude. Is Agassi video, is that the, that's
well,
what
he
recommend?
He refused to practice on grass ahead of Wimbledon 92. He just went and practiced on a hard court because he decided that was his game. And he put his hard court game on grass. I mean, admittedly, he was up against serve and volley, so that was different. But is it that different these days? I mean, it is a bit, it is different, but they're harder than they've ever been, those courts. They're truer bounces. I think she, look, it's very easy for someone like me to say, oh, get out your own way. But I kind of feel that if she could simplify it,
Isn't that what everyone does now, David, though? They just put their game on grass. Does anyone really come out and say, I'm going to play a grass court game?
Well, I think
our
assumption of a grass court game is serving and volleying and going to the net, when actually I think a lot of it is more about how low you get to the ball and how you guide the ball, whereas on everything else, you're hitting the ball, you're swiping, you're hitting, imparting spin, top spin. Whereas I think on grass, I mean, I always listen to Andy Murray and Leighton Hewitt talking about themselves as grass court players, and neither one of those is charging towards the net every point, but they're doing it in a slightly different way. They're taking a ball on the rise and redirecting it. And I just feel as though there's nothing that Osaka can't do on that surface. Look at the serve for starters. Mm. You know, she should be loving it. And I think a lot of it is just if she can just start enjoying it.
There's so little time for her to do that, though, isn't it? It's basically one warm up tournament and then boom.
Yeah,
you're into a Grand Slam and.
When was the last time she even played on grass? I guess it would have been 2019 Wimbledon. Well, I think she lost to Putintseva, if I'm not mistaken, quite early in that tournament. She's not had any reps on that surface for 3 years.
Should help that she'll get on show courts, I think. You know, I think that would help her. Those bigger, better kept courts.
Mm. Okay. Well, that's for another discussion for a few months down the line. Iga Świątek now heads on to clay. I was going to lazily say her favourite surface, but, you know, she might now call hard courts a favourite surface. She might no longer have a favourite surface because she can do it anywhere, anytime. But she heads on to clay, where she's won her one and only Grand Slam on a 17-match winning streak.
Help us all, said Jessica Pegula, which I think feels accurate.
Yeah, she's sort of becoming a spokeswoman, isn't she, for just all of our thoughts. So that is Iga Świątek, just an extraordinary feat. Four in love over Naomi Osaka, youngest player ever to win the Sunshine Double. Laura Siegmund and Vera Zvonareva, with a combined age of 71, won the doubles title. They beat top seeds Elise Mertens and Veronika Kudermetova 7-6, 7-5. I know players are getting older, and, you know, doubles players can play for a long time, but it's quite old, isn't it? They've done well there.
Ash Barty's retired and Vera Zvonareva isn't. What a world.
Indeed.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
In the men's tournament, 18-year-old Carlos Alcaraz beat Casper Ruud 7-5, 6-4 to become the youngest ever ATP Miami winner, the third youngest ATP Masters 1000 winner after Michael Chang and, yep, Rafael Nadal. There were scenes with his coach Juan Carlos Ferrero both before that final and immediately after it. I can't stop replaying that hug in my mind. He played the match of the week. Previous to that, did Carlos Alcaraz 6-7, 6-3, 7-6 over Miromir Ketsmanovic, who, by the way, is shaping up to be a serious player from now onwards. I think we need to reframe who we think Miromir Ketsmanovic is. Maybe we were in the process of doing that, but it's time to confirm that. Hubert Hurkacz got the better of Daniil Medvedev in that matchup we were previewing on our last podcast. Matt's written fish on a sofa next to this bullet point.
Explain.
We'll need to. Maybe we should just explain that now. Get that out of the way.
You obviously missed this quote. I mean, it feels like it does need explaining if you haven't seen it. But yeah, that was Daniil Medvedev's description of himself. During that match, he said he was like a fish on a sofa because he was just cramping so much and his body was sort of contorting. He does not enjoy the heat and humidity, I think, Medvedev. I've only really seen him look like that before in heat and humidity. Do you remember last year in Miami? He was walking like an old man, wasn't he, with his cramping. We saw him at the Tokyo Olympics really struggling as well. That is an area he doesn't like. We've obviously subsequently found out that he's been struggling with a hernia, and he's had a hernia operation. He's out now for potentially a couple of months, so I'm sure that was contributing as well. But yeah, fish on a sofa feels like, you know, I was trying to find the words for what Medvedev looked like on that court, and of course Medvedev himself came up with the words. That feels like a quote that we'll be going back to.
Yes, and of course he did the dead fish celebration when he won the US Open last year, so...
Yes.
Whether intentional or not, he's...
he's got a theme.
Fit fish is going to become his thing. But anyway, back to Carlos Alcaraz, who... we're not going to be able to avoid hyperbole and bandwagon jumping and all of it, because I think he's changing the sport. I really do. Everything that I said on Thursday, you know, looks like he's sent from the future. Rinse and repeat. He's different. He's something else.
I said that changing the sport line in one of our tweets this week and got a little bit of pushback. And I was thinking about why I think he's changing the sport. And it seems to me like a combination of the way he's playing. You know, in terms of his combination of speed and power is not something I remember seeing, especially from an 18-year-old. You know, you think when Nadal came along, and I'm really trying not to compare him to Nadal all the time, but when Nadal came along, he didn't have a serve like Alcaraz has got. You know, Alcaraz can get that serve up to 140 miles an hour. He didn't have a backhand like Alcaraz has got. He's got awesome power on both wings and this incredible speed. So the playing style is different, but also to be getting these results at this age, I thought the days of teenagers winning big on the ATP tour were pretty much over, and I thought they were pretty much over with Nadal and with Djokovic and with Murray and with Del Potro. Those players have taken the physicality to a level which is just so extreme now. And we've seen a lot of talented players come along in the last 15 years or so, but it's always taken them time. You know, look at Thiem, the way he's physically built up. Look at the way Medvedev has sort of become physically strong and figured out his own game. And Alcaraz is the first player I can remember since Nadal, Murray, Djokovic, who's just immediately come along and just looked like a problem. He just looks like a problem for the best players in the world already. And yeah, those are the ways for me which I would sort of justify this idea of him changing the sport. And that is what I believe right now, is what we're seeing from him.
Wow. I mean, they're lofty words, but I mean, that's how he makes you feel when you're watching him, because he's got bits of all those big three. I'm not saying he is them all combined, but he's got parts of their game in his, from the obvious comparisons with Nadal because of being Spanish, because of the manner in which he carries himself, the way he looks like he's been plugged into the mains from ball one, the exuberance, the perseverance that he showed during those matches that you've just described in which he was down. He was a set down against Miomir Kecmanovic, who was playing out of his mind. Who was wonderfully impressive, and yet he still got the better of him. And in that final against Casper Ruud, he was 4-1 down. And he was 4-1 down a couple of times in these matches and just not quite hitting his straps. He was a bit erratic. Maybe it was a bit of nerves. Maybe he's going for too much. I think he does that occasionally early on. But there's something special about him inside where he'll just tap into whatever it is. And once he then goes flat out, he's got a sort of foot-to-the-floor speed that nobody else seems able to live with. And I saw it in parts in the match against Casper Ruud. There was a side-to-side match where Ruud, who is fast, he is quick around the court, and he has got blistering power on the ground strokes. And he was going toe-to-toe. And yet still the final shot is won by Carlos Alcaraz, because he just has that little extra. And then he's got the ability to contort himself a little bit like Djokovic does. He seems so supple. He's much more lithe than a Nadal. He's much more physically built like a Djokovic. And then you've got somebody who's prepared to serve and volley at this age, 18. You know, he's not a serve and volleyer, and yet he's throwing second serve and volley points with a kick serve and coming in and looking completely at ease at the net at this age, at important moments, match-turning moments. I mean, look, that doesn't mean anything for the long run, necessarily. It bloody well feels like it does, though. And it feels like he's just got it. He's just got it in the mind. When he would win a couple of those points and be walking back to his position, looking up at Ferrero and the other people in his box and just nodding. And it was just a sort of, yeah, I'm okay. I've got this. I know exactly what I'm doing. I've got it in me. And he's not looking for any instruction. He's just looking for connection so that he can let everybody know, don't worry, I've got this now. Now we win. Some player, this guy.
I'm going to repeat the analogy that I used in our WhatsApp chat with Mary Carrillo that she approved of and complimented, because there is no greater compliment. So I think it deserves a second airing, which is it's quite a niche analogy, perhaps. But he makes me think about the late 90s in figure skating, when Alexei Yagodin started consistently performing a quad in men's figure skating. And Yevgeny Plyshenko quickly caught up and developed quads himself. A quadruple jump, so four rotations in the air. Before that, triples, and in particular the triple axel, which is... an axel is an extra half rotation, so three and a half. That was the jump that the men were performing, and that seemed, you know, a quad was, don't at me, I know that Yagodin wasn't the first. I know Kurt Browning was the first. It had been done, you know, once or twice, you know, people had just eked one out. But I'm talking about somebody that consistently showed up, had a quad in his arsenal and changed the game. If he landed that quad, if he showed up and performed, that was it. Nobody else stood a chance. It completely changed the sport. And I look at, you know, Tsitsipas and Zverev and Rublev, maybe even Felix Auger-Aliassime, great, great players. But they look to me like the rest of the pack that were left standing around clutching their measly triple axels to me. And that doesn't mean that they're not going to win slams, because we know that no matter how brilliant a tennis player is, they don't win everything. But it feels to me like, injury permitting, it's crumbs off the table. They'll win slams, they will, but they'll win the ones that Alcaraz doesn't. The game is in Alcaraz's hands for me.
Which I suppose the question to ask now is when is the first one?
David's got the answer to that, Matt. You've asked the right question to the right man.
I answered that months ago, folks, let's be honest. Oh, by the way, Mary also said that she views Alcaraz as the fastest player she's ever seen across the court. And that really took me aback, because I'm the one who does the stupid hyperbole around here. And Mary doesn't. You know, so if she's saying it,
Mary validated a lot of our hyperbole, didn't she?
Yeah, and I
we
said
feel
to
more confident in delivering it.
I found myself saying, "Now, Mary, Bjorn Borg was incredibly quick, and Leighton Hewitt was incredibly quick, and Michael Chang and Rafael Nadal and Novak Djokovic." And she was clear in her mind that he has got the more explosive speed, the greater horsepower, she said. You know, you've got different types of quickness. You've got Borg, who's lithe. You've got Hewitt, who's short, and therefore is able to scuttle, isn't he? And Dimonor, those types. And Nadal is this thunderous horse who's running back and forth. But, yeah, he does make you double take Alcaraz, the way he keeps rallies going. And by the way, on the subject of Mary, she also wanted me to address, or she put me right on the is Ash Barty and the GOAT debate, didn't she? The greatest of all time debate on her measly 3 Grand Slam singles titles. But I mean, she was pointing out in our exchange that you need longevity. You need to have been able to dominate for a long time.
You didn't argue that she was in the GOAT debate, did you?
I raised it. I raised whether her level in the Ash Barty Retires show, whether her level over that year and a half will be something we will remember as a level that was of that standing. So quite happy to say that no, she's not the GOAT.
Well, the good news is that lots of our other takes from recent podcasts, David, thanks to Iga Świątek and Carlos Alcaraz, have aged well.
And we're looking big picture, long term there at Carlos Alcaraz. I actually think in the short term, his winning that he's done over the last couple of months is a great injection into the ATP tour. And I think I've thought this for a while. One of the consequences of Nadal, Djokovic being in their mid 30s now is that they have had to prioritise and really focus on majors. And it has, I think, detracted a little bit from the week-in, week-out tour that the best players in the world are not that focused on them. You know, if they lost in those tour events, it was kind of like, well, how much can you read into that? Because they're different players at the Slams. And of course, they're going to keep being different players at the Slams. So in that respect, you know, this was a week that Alcaraz won without Nadal and without Djokovic. But at the same time, we've got a player now, Alcaraz, 18, who's just ravenous and capable and wanting to win everything. And we're going to have him. Okay, we've seen him schedule sensibly, but we're going to have him pretty much at every big tour event. And he's going to be kind of at his best, you'd have thought. And that is an exciting prospect. I'm excited to see him come up against Djokovic, hopefully on the clay over the next few months. I'm excited to see him play Nadal again on clay. And I'm excited to see him play the players you've listed there, Catherine, that sort of, you know, that group, Tsitsipas, Rublev, etc. Because he's now like the big test on the tour. You know, he's someone who... Well, Nadal said he's playing top eight tennis, didn't he, a couple of weeks ago. I think you could shift that up to top five, really, at the moment. He is that guy right now, and that's an exciting prospect, I think, for the tour.
That's such a good point. And that is an answer, Matt, which will please Billie Jean King immensely. You've said majors and slams. I heard you mix that in there, and you've also bigged up the tours.
I want to see him play against a big server. I'm trying to think of matches he's played against really big servers, and I can't think of many. And I'm looking forward to seeing him try to do that. You know, Kyrgios, Medvedev, we didn't get to see that match, and we're going to have a bit of a wait for it, aren't we? I remember seeing him play Zverev, and he lost pretty straightforwardly a year ago. I mean, he was a very different player then. But that's a test that I feel like I haven't really seen yet.
Okay.
And, yep. And that bond with Juan Carlos Ferrero, oh. That's special. Oh. That really is special. And I think, again, a lot of top players have someone who's been with them the whole time, or they have someone with whom they have a special bond. Tony Nadal, Marion Vida, Severin Luti, you know, just to pick at the big three there. And Juan Carlos Ferrero could be that guy for Alcaraz. Look, who knows what will happen? But sharing a moment like they did this week with Juan Carlos Ferrero having a really, really difficult time. His father dying, I think, just in between Indian Wells and Miami. He flew back to Spain, and then there was that incredible video of him coming back for the final to surprise Alcaraz. And Alcaraz was writing on the camera throughout tributes to Eduardo, who was Juan Carlos Ferrero's father. That's a special thing they have shared this week. I just think something like that will bond them together for a long, long time. And I think that's important to have that figure in your career, in your life. I always think back to Chris Clary's book about Federer and the people surrounding him being important. And Mary says that as well. And I think Ferrero is that guy for Alcaraz.
I need you to take over, David, because I can't even think about that hug without tearing up a bit.
Moment in the hotel where suddenly Juan Carlos Ferrero's arrival is kind of announced and Alcaraz just jumps out of his seat and like dances. He's like dancing over to him. He's like he's just scored a goal at his team and he just wants to embrace him.
But it's so childlike
him.
As well.
Yeah,
he's so,
it's
you
lovely.
Know, he's so much a man in so many ways that to see him just look like a kid.
And the thing is, I was around when Juan Carlos Ferrero was Alcaraz's age, and this he's a quieter presence, Ferrero. I think he's a more slight individual who just had this sort of waspish ability to hurt people on the court. But he was very likable back then. I remember he always thought he seemed like a really nice fella all the way through. And this movement into kind of father figure or big brother figure, is it really suits him. He has a lovely demeanour on the sidelines in the box and with Alcaraz. It really works. I don't get the sense that it needs to be about him in any way. He's just trying to support him and nurture him, and the pride that he looks at him with, it looks very healthy.
Was he one of the new balls, please, for Aaron?
Yes. I've got the picture somewhere of them all lined up. I must dig that out.
And now he's father figure, mentor, coach for the new balls.
Yeah.
Oh, really gets me.
You're all right, Catherine.
What else happened in Miami? Somebody help me here.
Well,
Hercatch, brilliant title defence from Hercatch,
yeah,
wasn't it? He impressed by that.
Played brilliantly and just there was that lovely moment in his match with Alcaraz where Alcaraz conceded a point or let him replay a point because there was a not-up call against Hercatch who was shown on the screen to have reached a ball and Alcaraz just said, yeah, let's just play it again. And you could see how much Hercatch appreciated that. And actually, that was a bit of a theme of the tournament, the latter stages, the good sportsmanship. We had another one between Ruud and Alcaraz as well. Just good blokes, I felt, duking it out. And then you got Hercatch joining up with John Isner for Isner to win the Sunshine doubles crown, Indian Wells with Sock and here with Hercatch in Miami. I mean, that's a fantastic achievement from Hercatch to go all the way in both like that. And then, of course, there was the man that he beat in his match, Medvedev, saying he's got a hernia issue and he's had a small operation and he's out for, one or two months. And that probably means the clay isn't going to happen for him, which... Maybe he's not going to lose any sleep over. He didn't look right, did he, in the heat? But he didn't necessarily look as though he was on full charge into the corners. And maybe a hernia might explain it.
It's funny, though, isn't it? Because, you know, take away the clay court season from Medvedev, which, okay, you know, none of us would have been picking him to win titles. But there was an opportunity to maybe build on the progress that he made last year, pick up a few extra ranking points. I know he's not got much pedigree on grass, but he says he enjoys it. He likes playing on grass. I think he backs himself to figure it out and improve his results. But, you know, who knows what's going to happen this year on the grass. So he's going to be going into the latter portion of the season with a lot of pressure on him on the hard courts, recovering from surgery with a lot of points to defend, and suddenly, you know, that feeling of inevitability about him getting back to world number one. You know, when somebody's a match away, I always sort of think, you know, you build up the tension and jeopardy, but I always think, okay, but if it's not this match, it'll probably be the next one. You know, if you get to a match away, it's probably going to happen. And I certainly felt a feeling of, well, of course he'll get back to number one, but it suddenly feels that bit less inevitable. And I really feel like he does not want to be that 2 weeks at number one guy, especially given the circumstances of him getting to number one. He's been muted since his country declared war on Ukraine. And that's very understandable. It would almost be sort of inhuman if he weren't a little muted. But it is, I think it's a factor in him as a tennis player at the moment. So I think, you know, his comeback from that surgery is going to be an interesting one to watch. Mirmir Ketsmanovic, what's his potential? Who is he now as a tennis player, and where has this come from? Last year, he won 17 matches on tour, including qualifying matches. And this year, he's already won 18 main draw matches. He is a completely transformed player.
Am I going to take the Ketsmanovic question again this
mm-hmm.
week?
Yes.
I was looking back on the notes I made, and I've mentioned this match before. I watched him in the Davis Cup at the very end of last season against Mikhail Kukushkin. It was a 3.5-hour match, and the notes I made were just Ketsmanovic, so many missed opportunities. And when it mattered in the big moments, he was really passive, like so passive. He had the match ripped from him by Mikhail Kukushkin. That is what happened in pretty much the final match he played last year. And the Ketsmanovic I watched this year seems to have corrected that mindset. You know, the way he went after the ball against Alcaraz throughout the whole 2.5-hour match couldn't have been more different to the guy I watched at the end of last season. He came up with so many incredible shots under pressure. You know, there were a lot of key moments in that match with Alcaraz, and both of them kind of produced their best tennis at the biggest moments. And that's kind of a mark of a great match. And the angles Ketsmanovic creates on his ground strokes, the way he's able to pull players off the court, makes me think that he could certainly have a game that suits clay as well. So I'm excited to watch him over the next couple of months on that surface. And yeah, I think you said it at the top of the show, Catherine, reframing how we see Miomir Kecmanovic, because I thought of him as someone who was going to hover around 50 in the world and have a good career, maybe the odd run to, you know, a third, fourth, maybe quarter final of a major, something like that. But yeah, he's already doing way better than I thought he would with this little patch of form he's had now, and it feels pretty sustainable. It doesn't feel like he's absolutely peaking necessarily. It just feels like he's raised his level, and I'm so impressed with him.
I spoke to a friend of mine that works for the ATP and does films a lot of their content, or produces a lot of their content, because I feel like I don't know Miomir Kecmanovic. Like, who is he? I feel like I haven't seen many interviews with him. And she actually went and filmed a feature on him for the ATP in Serbia at the end of last year. She met his grandparents. She met his parents, his grandparents, you know, went to his local club where he started playing tennis. And she said he's, you know, he's got a bit of swagger about him. You know, she said the right amount of cockiness. But she said he's basically a lovely guy. And she said he's super popular behind the scenes. Everybody likes him. All the other players on tour like him. And yeah, she, you know, proud grandparents, which, you know, don't know what's wrong with me today, but that's going to make me tear up as well.
I don't know whether what he was like before his association with David Nalbandian, but there's another coach who was playing alongside Juan Carlos Ferreira back in the day. And they've been together for quite a while, Nalbandian and Kecmanovic. Not the most likely of combinations, really. An Argentine former top 10 player alongside a 50s in the world player from Serbia. It's not something that I would necessarily have expected, albeit Kecmanovic is now much higher. But when you actually just watch him play, there are a lot of similarities. He moves in a similar way. His stroke production reminds me of Nalbandian. There's a real smoothness to it all, and yet there's a pop off the strings. He was going properly toe-to-toe with Alcaraz and holding his own. It was quite something to witness that. I like these bonds that last for a while and you don't immediately kick a coach to touch just because it doesn't go that well, or the coach doesn't just dump a player because they're not breaking through immediately. Proper work in progress, and they're showing results. Good for them.
Absolutely. What else happened in Miami, the latter stages of Miami? Cameron Norrie had another good run, didn't he? Another creditable week. God, that's such a Cam Norrie adjective I've just used there, isn't it? Sort of damning by faint praise. Now, he's had another great week, Cameron Norrie, and in particular because he has reached the top 10, fourth British man to do so since rankings began in 1973. He follows Greg Rusedski, Tim Henman and Andy Murray, which are pretty great shoes to be walking in. So well done, Cameron Norrie. That is an extraordinary feat, actually. And, you know, repeat all the things I've said about him in the past few weeks. Wasn't expecting him, quite honestly, to back up last season in the way that he has. And I'm just full of admiration for him. Jack Draper is continuing his sort of quiet consolidation and rise up the rankings. His fourth challenger title of the year in Brittany, France, 6-4 in the third, in the final for him over Zizou Bergs, who I know nothing about, but hope succeeds in life because it's a great name.
He's big on TikTok, I believe.
Oh, okay. Well, you'd have to be with a name like that.
And he's Belgian.
Great. He's up to number 124 in the world, which means he overtakes Liam Brody as the British number four. I've got some dispatches here from you, David. You would like to say a thank you to a listener.
Yes, I would. To Martin Workman, who let me know that there is a way to watch tennis TV matches without spoiling the result for myself, because they actually offer a spoiler-free option so that you don't have this match duration at the bottom of the screen. Yeah, I just wanted to let other people know that that's available as well, because I often hear from people saying how frustrating they find that element. But it's sorted, thanks to Martin.
Big help with catching up on the Ketsmanovic-Alcaraz match, because that happened in the middle of the night, didn't it? So that's Miami done and dusted. This week we have events in Charleston, which I always say is one of the events I'm most desperate to go to. Iga Świątek is very understandably pulled out, but they've got Sabalenka, Badosa, Bencic, Pliskova, Jabeur, Sloane Stephens, Petra Kvitova, Leila Fernandez, Pegula, Rybakina. They've got a great field in Charleston. And I think of Charleston last year as the place that I first sat up and took notice of Paula Badosa. She beat Barty, didn't she, in Charleston last year. So interested to see her. She's had a few sort of niggles, hasn't she, recently? Sort of illness, fatigue, I don't know. Eyes on Badosa this clay court season for me. There's also a WTA event in Bogota where Camila Osorio is the defending champion. That was, again, sort of where I first sat up and took notice of her this time last year. And this time around, she's the top seed. ATP has events in Houston where you've got Nick Kyrgios playing, Riley Opelka, Taylor Fritz, John Isner, Casper Ruud, understandably, withdrew from that one. And the ATP are also in Marrakesh, where Felix Auger-Aliassime and Dan Evans are the top two seeds. So we'll be covering all of those events next week. Our first sort of glimpse of what the clay court season might look at before the big dogs enter the fray. We'll also be recording a Friends Q&A show on Thursday for Friends of the Tennis podcast. Your excellent questions have flooded in their droves, and we'll be doing our very best to answer all of those on Thursday. So that'll be up then. Look out for that if you are a friend of the Tennis podcast. And if you're not but would like to be, then details are in our show notes. And we strongly recommend and encourage becoming a friend of the show. So we'll be back on Monday. David won't be there because he's bobbing off on holiday.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yes. So yes, becoming a friend of the Tennis podcast is your way to get a David fix over the next couple of weeks. There's
Don't
a selling point.
Yes, now we can track the trajectory of the numbers and see in data form how much of a human incentive David Law is.
Suddenly all the people that have been not listening return.
David is going on holiday just as my Indian Wells tan fades, so that's a shame. But Matt and I will be back, and we may even produce special guests. Don't want to overpromise, but Matt and I will be back. And as a minimum, we'll have Billie Jean on the show, because Matt and I are going to record in person next Monday. I'm very excited about that. Matt, I put some orange squash in my Ocado order today because you're coming.
Oh, thank you very much. Dates?
Oh.
No. You're taking aversion to the dates.
I can pop to the shop and get you some dates. Right,
I've come across as horribly ungrateful. Thank you for the orange squash.
That was a lovely moment of silence.
It's like dates are your rider, Matt. Right there, we have two mascots this week. I'm looking at pictures of them. We've got Alf and Piper. They're owned by a friend of the Tennis podcast, Lauren Boyle. Alf is a Shar Pei, and Shar Pei, if you don't know Shar Peis, they've got those beautiful, they've got such great faces. They've got those rolls of skin, and they've got funny little ears, and they're just gorgeous. So Alf is at least 7 years old. Which is a great way of expressing one's age. I feel like I'm saying I'm at least 25 years old. No need for any further details. Piper is a four-year-old Shar Pei crossed with something unknown. I'm just looking at Piper and trying to, I think possibly a Labrador. That's my diagnosis. Shar Pei Labrador Cross. They live in Newcastle, Australia, and it's a lovely picture of Alf and Piper. We'll pop it on our Instagram. So thank you, Lauren, for bringing Alf and Piper into our lives and for being a friend of the podcast. We have our mascots, Carter, Darwin and Gerald. Billie Jean, who's asleep on my knee right now, has Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our two executive producers, Chris Albert Lee and Kyle Weingartner. And Matt, we have shout outs.
We do. We have Seppa Momarts, who is Belgian but living in Vancouver.
Belgian like Zizou.
Yes.
Zizou. Do they only have good names in Belgium?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
And actually, Seppa has picked out a couple of Belgian favourites from the 90s, David.
Oh,
Dominique Monami.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've worked with her.
Wasn't she formerly Van Roost?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
And Philip De Wolf.
Oh, brilliant. He's now a journalist. He's quite a big journalist in Belgium. A nice bloke, too. And I think he got to French Open quarters or semis once.
That is great niche Belgian 90s tennis player knowledge. I hope.
What about
Seppa
Dick Norman?
Is...
When's Dick Norman?
Well, he hasn't been
up?
Named.
Well, disappointed. But
the
since you're a friend.
Brothers, you know, what about Clijsters and Ennan? There are others, David.
Yeah, those are
Seppa
not, those
didn't
are
explain
all
that
after.
That was claim that that was an exclusive list. Anyway, thank you, Seppa, very much for your support.
It is one of my favourite things that you can just name a random tennis player from the 90s and David will have a fact or an anecdote or something. I love it. We also have Leslie Gianelli from Wallingford, Connecticut.
Oh, Leslie. I thought Leslie Gianelli was going to be from Sicily or something. That's a great name.
That's a brilliant name.
There's a Wallingford near where my parents live in Berkshire. Maybe it's Oxfordshire, actually, Wallingford. I've jumped off the bridge at Wallingford into the river.
Oh, my goodness. How did that turn out?
Great. It was a thrill.
it's
good to know there's one in Connecticut as well.
Have you ever had any Leslie tennis players?
Leslie
Bowery.
Leslie Bowery.
Oh.
Leslie Allen.
Yes. Yeah, of course we have.
Two friends of the show.
And this Leslie, Catherine, is a figure skating judge.
Oh, crikey. Oh, and I've used a figure skating analogy on this episode. Hmm. Oh, it's all working out perfectly. Hello, Leslie. Thank you for support.
And finally today we have Lisa Wiersma from Chicago.
Hello, Lisa.
And Lisa has two tennis-loving pups, and you're going to love this. One of them is named Cliffy, and the reason... Oh. They're named Cliffy is because Lisa watched so much tennis over the years and loved hearing the name when Pam Shriver would talk to Cliff Drysdale on ESPN.
Oh, that's lovely.
That's a great story.
Oh. Are there any tennis playing Lisas?
Lisa Raymond.
Lisa Raymond.
Yeah. That's it.
I'm out.
Well, Lisa, you share a name with Lisa Raymond. Congratulations. Thank you very much for your support. Thank you to all friends of the Tennis Podcast. You'll be getting a show on Thursday. We'll be back with our regular weekly show on Monday when David will be getting sort of a tan. He'll be back in a couple of weeks, though. Don't you worry. We will speak to you soon. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.